it's like one of my crusades is it, as long as I work in this space, is certainly to show that the text box is you know, and text is just not the only way to interact with these tools.
Renee here at Unsupervised Learning, your easy listening podcast for bleeding edge open source tech.
No, I think there is something to like physical things. So I spoke to someone the other day that uses a Stream Deck to do home automation. And he said that he like twists a thing and then the lights come on. And I was like, oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And that's what I don't know what Rabbit does at all, but that's like a piece of hardware.
Yeah.
So that's one of my wondering if hardware is going to be a thing in the future. I don't know.
Yeah. Hardware is, I think there's so much, it's one of like those things that has really disappointed me, actually. If you want to say like another hot take about tech and AI, I've been so, more tech, but like I've been so disappointed about how little like innovation there's been in hardware, you know, over the last like 20 years. Like, yeah, of course. I mean, we have like VR glasses, you know, VR, AR stuff, and we have iPhones, and like there's like some great things, but those are like singular inventions in like a decade, mm-hmm. right? When you think about that compared to how many different like types of software we have, and you know, it's a matter of economics, it's a matter of supply chains and difficulty of building new hardware. I wish there was more, because something about it just being tangible makes it so satisfying, like to hold, to interact with. I think, yeah, that's one downside, I think, to the sort of software eating the world prophecy from, you know, Andreessen, like, which has probably played out to be more or less true so far. But we've lost something about the physicality of our day-to-day experiences that I wish we could get back.
You know what I'm going to title this video?
What?
Man angry at lack of hoverboards. Man shakes fists because there is no flying cars.
Bessons promised me flying cars.
Yeah, but no, I get what you're saying. So I'm sitting here today with film star Natalie Portman. I'm kidding. You know the Lonely Island?
What Lonely Island? Like the...
The band.
Like the SNL thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was from the Natalie Portman rap in like 2009.
My God.
And every time I hear I'm sitting here today, I think of film star Natalie Portman. Sawyer, this is the thing. I've never said your last name out loud.
Middle ear.
Oh, like middle ear.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Sawyer Middle Ear, who is working as chief of staff at Omni, an AI agent for
B2B sales.
B2B sales. And do you want to kick it off? Maybe some background into how you got into the AI space. Was Omni your gateway drug?
Yeah. So I actually first got into the AI space building independently. So when I worked at the company I was at prior to Omni, I was seeing ChatGPT launch and a lot of cool AI tools launch. And I've always sort of been a tinkerer when it comes to new technology and a lot of stuff that's been open sourced and just available online. And so was really eager to get my hands on the OpenAI API and started to build some independent projects with it pretty much as soon as it came out. And so that was my first foray into all of this, and built some little projects, which I can talk about later on, I guess. But no, otherwise, in like a kind of proper work capacity, Omni was the first time I got to work with generative AI. And prior to Omni, the only experience that I had with machine learning and AI systems was pricing optimization models that I worked on at an e-commerce company before that. So I joined Omni working with, at the time, the solo founder, David, back in late May, early June. Really just doing the very early stages of user research, market research, and then eventually, you know, built it into a full company.
And where are you at now with Omni? Like, who do you serve?
So right now, Omni, we serve customers in B2B sales, but the unifying thing is that these are companies and organizations that sell to larger mid-market and enterprise buyers. So we really support these more complex, longer sales cycles that are very research-driven and very kind of consultative in nature.
And I only found out the other day that, did you say you're a Python teacher's assistant?
I was, yeah, in grad school. I was TA for our data analytics with Python classes.
That's really cool. And I remember, I think, I don't know if it was a tweet that you did that was like, said SQL is unlocked to, I'm just going to make up a quote that you said and just put words in your mouth, but it's essentially sure. like SQL is like an unlock for ops people. And I sat with myself and I was like, I don't know SQL. But it was a great point. I feel like Python is something like foundational that is great to know going into AI. You just explained how you made the decision to go with your ICP, but you surprised by how much these AI agents could do? Or like when you joined Omni, what did you think you were joining?
Early on, I honestly had no idea. It was pretty amazing to see this vibrant and like super passionate community of users just from the beginning. I mean, this was the height of the hype and craze around, at the time, I think it was GPT 3.5, which was out, and maybe GPT 4 at that point. And there was just so much excitement around it. So it was super fun to talk to users where I'd DM somebody or email somebody, and of course they would want to talk to me and would interview them. And yeah, it was a really great experience. So it started off, like I said, sort of just doing interviews and market research to try to figure out like what direction should we point the ship in. And then it became something that was a little bit more sales and marketing oriented, and also just the basic operations of starting up the company and getting our accounting in order, getting our legal in order. I think, interestingly, I never really especially wanted to work at an AI company. I was more just drawn by the really interesting technology and the opportunity to work with these tools that I, you know, that are just so fascinating and have so much possibility. When I first started using Omni, it like there was just this like holy shit moment where, you know, you put in your query, and then at the time it was just this research tool. So you would put in your query and it would go off and do research. And, you know, 2 minutes later, you'd get this whole report that would have taken you probably half an hour to put together by yourself. And when we started to build the sales tool, so this was a little bit later on, same moments happened where it would go off and do research on these you know, prospects that you were trying to sell to, and it would make these inferences about how to sell to them, what messaging is going to be most effective for various buyers. And it was still early on, and so the tech was a little bit inconsistent. Sometimes the answer would be a little bit out of left field, but sometimes there would just be gold in there. And like, I knew seeing some of these outputs that were so much more sophisticated and so much more detailed than what you would get from vanilla ChatGPT or Bard, there's really something here that's special.
Because I know we met through Generalist World, which is a community online. And I think that there is like a really big cross section of people interested in AI and very generalist mindsets, or very potentially like neurodivergent people, not labeling you, but definitely. Yeah, so I don't know if you want to start with urban planning or your own projects or whatever.
Sure. Let me start with the generalist world thing, and then I can talk more about the urban planning. So I think the thing that, and then your prior guest who we were talking about earlier, the account executive, he put it in such a perfect way that I also really resonate with. Like when I started using ChatGPT to write code, I'm somewhat technical, I would say, right? Like I have a background in programming through undergrad and independent projects in grad school, but like by no means am I an engineer or data scientist or anything. And when I got my hands on ChatGPT and started to build out projects with it, felt like I had superpowers. Like, you know, here I am, like it would take me probably a month to build the things that with ChatGPT I could put together in a weekend. And so as a generalist with a lot of different interests and, you know, no super deep expertise, certainly in any technical area or any area of like subject matter, for the most part, being able to have this like augmentation really of knowledge that, you know, and then when you have AI agents that layer on even more kind of ability to sort of support you in workflows that are more complex than just kind of prompting something and getting an answer back. These tools are so exciting because it lets me, without any of those specialized skills, really take on bigger problems and projects. So that's been great. And Yeah, the urban planning thing. I mean, you know, I think it's a pretty typical story for anybody who's got a kind of generalist skill set and background where my undergrad, I didn't know really have any sort of plans going out of school. I didn't want to be a consultant. I didn't want to be a banker. I didn't want to be an engineer. But I was really interested in cities and urban planning and fell into that kind of career path, first in the private sector doing affordable housing and mixed income housing development, and then went to grad school to do research around affordable housing and community development. And when I was in grad school, got very interested in social entrepreneurship, and a lot of the work that was going on in Chicago focused on kind of community-driven entrepreneurship, local entrepreneurship. And ended up working through internships and through some startups with various companies and founders and investors that were in that space. And that was kind of like a gateway drug into startups in general, where I just felt like so much more at home being a startup operator than working in like a traditional government policy setting, which is just so slow, right? Like I was like, here I was sitting in policy school seeing, you know, Waymo hit the streets with autonomous vehicles and Airbnb was having a huge impact on the property market. And city and state governments were just like twiddling their thumbs with no budget to do anything. And, you know, as somebody who's fairly impatient, it became a fairly easy choice to say, hey, there's this other career path where perhaps it's not as like mission driven per se, but there's a lot more opportunity to actually have an impact, I felt. And yeah, that's what sort of taken me in this direction. Absolutely have like a healthy cynicism around this stuff that like I think at the time I was a bit naive to. But I honestly do, and you know, perhaps still naively believe that like there are a lot of opportunities to do a lot of good in this space and still, you know, make shareholders happy and all that stuff. It doesn't have to be just, you know, all one or all the other.
I think it was Dan from Jan, Daniel, the co-founder of Jan, he mentioned, it was like in a public discussion on GitHub of all places, that there is like a little bit of virtue signaling with the open source space. And it's like, just because something's open source, not proprietary technology, doesn't mean that it's inherently better or virtuous, or there's a lot of, I think I am a professional fence sitter. And it's not for lack of conviction, it's just for openness, the whole strong opinions loosely held. And so I feel like, I think it's something that we potentially both struggle with as generalists. You're so open to so many different things that it can seem like, oh, you've got no opinions. And it's like, no, I do. I've got direction, just lots of different directions all at the same time.
Absolutely. Or it could be like, I have, you know, there might be a goal that I want to achieve, or a set of outcomes that I want to achieve, or problem spaces that I'm really excited about working on. But I think I bring a more diverse tool set than somebody else who might say, hey, look, I've got a wrench and a screwdriver. Like I can only use these two things. Whereas I'm coming in with a wrench, a screwdriver, a set of paints, you know, a computer over here, all this other random stuff. And so you get to be a little bit more creative. But I think at the same time, you always have to like be able to answer that question of like, why do you need to bring these tools to this particular problem? Like, there's always a trade-off that you make, right? And it's the same thing. There's also a trade-off that you make with open source versus closed source. There are good reasons why you might choose one versus the other.
Yeah. When you mentioned about frustrations, and this isn't, I feel like this should be a question that I ask people often. What frustrates you most about using like AI, an AI agent, or any part of the process?
Oh, what frustrates me the most? That's an interesting question.
My mind goes to prompting. I don't want to be, what's the word? Suggestive, though. I don't want to give you.
No, I think that's it. I think what really frustrates me the most about a lot of using a lot of these tools today is that like text input text box is just not the best interface to interact with most software tools. It's the same thing that frustrates me about like, you know, voice activated like Alexa and stuff. Like, it's great for some tasks, right? I love my parents' Alexa. I can tell it to play music, but I can't ask it to do much else for me, right? For worse, the computer screen with the mouse and keyboard and buttons and all of that is a really, really good user interface. And not to say that there aren't others, and I think AR, VR, that's all really cool and will come up. And I just think that like a text box is so limited. And in particular, it's not so much that it's like only one way of interacting with something, but there's so much, it's so difficult sometimes to actually express what you want through that simple input. You have to learn what are basically these magical spells that you need to input to this machine to get it to work, right? And it's not as if there's like that much logic to it necessarily. Like, there is a lot of logic and there's structure, and like there are a lot of great guides on prompt engineering out there. But still, there's like the peculiarities of how these systems are trained, and the fact that many of them are black boxes means that in order to prompt them well, there's almost this like trial and error that reminds me of when I used to study history in school and would read about how the ancient Romans would learn all these like magical spells in order to make sure that their crops would grow correctly and that, you know, their armies would win in battle. They had to learn all these intricate little steps and words to say, just because these things are, of course, very difficult to influence. And it's the same thing with these models in a kind of strange way. That's how I always feel using them. Like, I just want to click a few selection boxes and it'll make my life so much easier. But as general purpose tools, they need to be flexible, right? They can't, like the ChatGPTs and Bards, right? If that's all you have is input, this one text box that you use to do everything, it's on the one hand unlimited and totally open sandbox, which is great. But on the other hand, it's so difficult to interact with sometimes if there's a specific output that you're looking for.
It's kind of like needing, it's like if you're working at, I don't know, any SaaS, and it's like you need to be an expert in HubSpot and Airtable and whatever else, suddenly knowledge workers are all that more valuable because, like, yeah, you can have the engineering tool, but who's going to drive it? And this is like me battling for RevOps people everywhere because I feel like they're so valuable.
Yeah, but imagine if in order to put together a particular HubSpot, customization or something, it works automatically, which is great, but you have to spend half an hour trying to figure out how do I, prompt this thing just to get this exactly correct output. And it's fun. Don't get me wrong. I love tinkering with this stuff and exploring it. And there are people, I'm sure, who are much better prompt engineers than I. But it's like one of my crusades as long as I work in this space, is certainly to show that the text box is and text is just not the only way to interact with these tools. And neither is voice. Like there has to be some kind of multidimensional interaction mechanism.
Like neurotech?
No. I just mean something super simple. Buttons and interface, I think, and this is why, and you can only make this happen if you have more special purpose tools where you can, as a designer and as an engineering team or as a product team, anticipate what are my users trying to accomplish with this tool so that I can build an interface that supports it, right? That provides these mental shortcuts, these metonyms, so to speak, right? These analogies within user interface so that a user, rather than having to type out in words every single thing that they want to do and want to accomplish, they can simply just click here, drag there, whatever, and it just works the way that they intend to.
I'm thinking about he's suggesting the no code builders where it's like you drag a block and it's like this block is a...
I'm actually thinking of something a little bit different, which is not so much a no code builder so much as it is very, very simple user interfaces where the reason why you come to this tool is to accomplish a specific task, right? And you have, let's say, an AI agent within the tool that understands what your goals are, right? You're able to tell this software that you're collaborating with what goals you're trying to accomplish, what data you have access to in order to make decisions about how to accomplish those goals. And then the AI is intelligent enough to actually accomplish them and make decisions about how to do it, right? And so rather than having to put together, as you're describing, these fairly complicated flow charts, if then rules about how to build out these decision trees and workflows, it's actually something much simpler, which is to say hey, I want to be able to click a button here or maybe even not take any action at all. And the AI system should be intelligent enough to use the information it has to help me accomplish my goal. So that's the direction that we're building at Omni, for example. And there are a lot of other tools that are philosophically in kind of the same boat.
It makes me think of, I've used a lot of, I want to say no code web scraping tools where it's and I've just learned the word alignment and what that means in AI. And that's like the AI, or my definition, I'm going to butcher it, but that it's doing the thing that I want it to do in the way that I want to do it. And it knows. So absolutely. If I'm like, grab me content of the latest Reddit posts, it knows that I want it to go onto this subreddit and only grab like the top five most relevant. It's not going to go and grab the whole page and all of that sort of thing. And the other thing is, I'm thinking, does that mean that process automation is AI? Like,
not necessarily. I mean, I think it's kind of the reverse, which is that the best AI systems are a much more advanced version of process automation than I think many people who don't work in technical spaces are used to, right? So I think a lot of folks who work, for example, in RevOps are very accustomed to these workflow builders, or they're accustomed to these spreadsheet integrations where there's a lot of configuration that you need to do ahead of time. And I think what a lot of people don't appreciate is that when you are building those workflows and these automations, you're building in a lot of assumptions about the decisions that one should make using the data, right? But in reality, humans tend to be very bad at integrating a ton of data and making decisions about what filter criteria make the most sense, or what sorts of decisions are optimal based on the information that I have. And rather than building those assumptions into the system, I think a lot of people will see that it's a lot better to say, here's the data I have, here's the outcome that I'm trying to achieve. Let's say it's revenue, right? Just as an obvious one. And here's the tools that I have to work with. And the AI can be much more intelligent to actually make decisions about how best to do that, right? It can either suggest and collaborate with a user to accomplish those goals, or in some cases where it's very low stakes decisions, it can just take those actions by itself. Hmm. And like one simple example, right, is let's say you have a research agent that's helping you, for example, Emily does, right? We aggregate a bunch of information about the companies that you're trying to sell to from a bunch of different data sources in the internet. And our agent is smart enough to understand, based on that information, which of those pieces of data are most relevant for the seller to use within, let's say, a discovery call or something, right? We're not explicitly telling it, look for this keyword. We're not explicitly telling it, look for information within these dates. Rather, what it's doing is saying, given all this information and the objective of selling to this person, what information actually is best? And that's just like a very simple example. But I think as these systems get more advanced and people get more comfortable working with them, you'll see that kind of that kind of system become more and more commonplace.
It's interesting. Like, I think it was Predibase. They're in the UK, and they had a survey that like 220 something people, and it was why people, the uptake of LLMs isn't great in businesses. And it's like all the different reasons, like, oh, it hallucinates, I don't want to give it access to my data, all of these different things. And given that Omni is primarily B2B sales lead focused in enterprise and small to medium businesses, what kind of objections do you, like, if any, I'm assuming, do you have to overcome?
Yeah.
Typical?
Usually there are really three core things that we hear over and over. And they're all understandable. I mean, the first one is like concern around hallucination, right? Where something just to the effect of, the AI suggested X, but, in my opinion, I would do Y, right? And it works 80% of the time, that 20% of the time I would do it differently. And that's really understandable. I think it definitely mirrors a lot of the discussion that I've heard around, like, say, autonomous vehicles, right? Where, I mean, obviously what we're doing is much lower stakes, making mistakes is less, destructive in our case, luckily. But it's interesting because I think a lot of times people get very caught up on the negative and kind of de-emphasize or underappreciate the value that even if we're only correct 80% of the time, that 80% adds a ton of value. But even so, we actually tend to be right more often. And I think typically what happens is that people value their own experience and they value their own, they value their own judgment, sometimes at the expense of data. And so it takes a very open-minded person, I think, to be okay to like start to work with one of these systems. I think some people will demand that their system be perfect, you know, 99 or 100% of the time in order to feel like they can trust it. But I think a lot of people, certainly our early customers, are, you know, perfectly fine. They can see the value with all the value that we add in terms of time savings and improvement on the accuracy and quality of the information they get, and like the strategies that we're able to build for them, you know. And if we sometimes pull slightly out of date information, or the insights aren't exactly what they would have said, like they trust the system that it's either working as intended, or, you know, they're okay to sort of work out the kinks, I guess, and kind of because the systems are getting better all the time. And frankly, our AI agent, like I said, 80-20, we're not 80-20 anymore. I mean, I'd say that we get it right far more often than we get it wrong. And we're only improving as the models improve and as we just get a lot better at training these agents. So that the second thing is sort of related, which we definitely hear a lot more around more mature sales organizations, which is like some sales teams have these tech stacks of like 30 different tools. You know, not really. It's probably like 8 different tools, but these things are all wired together, and they have like their way of selling, right? And they have so much invested, both in terms of money and training, and, you know, also probably a little bit of like ego in doing it their way, that sometimes like there are definitely people who just are not interested in thinking about, well, maybe I could sell differently, right? Like maybe I don't have to send, you know, 1,000 emails per, you know, inbox a day to hit my number. Maybe I can do it much better with, say, fewer emails, or maybe I can, you know, drop a few of these point solutions and pick up something that builds a lot of the functionality into one. And inherent in that is not relying so much on having so like micro level control over everything that happens, but, you know, being tolerant of a probabilistic system within your workflow, which I think can be really challenging for some people. And then the last thing is just that there are a lot of teams that like see an AI system and they've been selling, you know, their sales teams, especially at like larger enterprises, legacy companies, they've been selling one way for 30 years. You know, they don't use like any sales tech that's launched in the last probably 8 to 10 years. Like that they have their relationships, they meet face to face. You know, actually, what's really interesting is that a lot of these teams are the ones that are most eager to adopt a tool like Omni or something in our realm once they kind of get comfortable with it, use it, and trial it out, because they don't even have to learn all this super complex automation, right? They don't have to have a RevOps team. They don't have to do all of this. It's literally like a plug and play system that works. Almost with like without that baggage of like the last 10 years of sales tech, they're a lot more tolerant of working with these systems, and you know, it's just a sort of a learning curve issue.
I think people think like there is a lot of, oh, AI has been around for so long. It's like, well, actual usable, no. Like I feel like a large majority of people think that have just suddenly, it's almost suddenly come into consciousness since like ChatGPT. It's only what, like a few years ago. So to expect, I think it's so right to expect a level of almost like grace, not lenience, but grace and understanding that it's collaborative. But then how do you move that and like align that with the whole like, oh, everything needs to be ROI right now. If it doesn't work, like I was doing almost like a self study on how quickly I will churn or leave a product if it doesn't fit my exact expectations. And I was like, I'm a horrible end user. I was mentioning to someone on a call earlier today that last year I tried 174 tools. Whoa. I was like, Renee, that's insane. I went through like my receipts, my old signups and everything, because I'm an early adopter of a lot of different stuff, like really enjoy it. But I think I understand like on a level that it's like, yeah, you do need to have understanding for these teams. Like it's a startup, you kind of got like a window of expecting bugs or lack of functionality. But it made me think about like the whole human in the loop thing, because you mentioned, mm-hmm. I know that there's a right term for it and I'm missing it right now, where it's like, it will check. What's that called? Do you know what that's called?
Yeah, human feedback, basically. I mean, or are you talking about like reinforcement learning?
I don't really know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you'll hear like RLHF, right? So like,
okay.
Yeah. Like reinforcement learning with human feedback. Yeah. Reinforcement learning from human feedback. So it's like, you know, the simple example is like, if you're using ChatGPT, there's the thumbs up, thumbs down. And yeah, I mean, I think that maybe a better way of putting what I was saying before is like, I think what we're definitely encountering is like, some people are very open to using these systems and are comfortable to like deal with the underlying models, which are unpredictable inherently. They're probabilistic systems. And I think some teams just require absolute certainty that everything that gets output is what they expect it to be. But yeah, the technology is always improving. And I think, you know, similar to how every kind of technological era comes with, you know, a lot of people who are uncomfortable using different technology or thinking about different workflows or just like different ways of solving problems. And then there are people who are very comfortable in those modes. We'll see the same things here, where I think over time, more and more people will just start to understand probabilistic systems better and say, hey, like, this is going to work 95% of the time, and 5% of the time it'll throw some kind of weird response, but I'm kind of aware enough of that that'll happen and I can catch it and regenerate that response and just go about my day.
That's such a good point. You started the call, I said that you were a little bit, you struck me as like very serious. And like, I know from knowing you that like you're a pretty realist person, but that's a very optimistic take for you to have. Where are you keeping up with, like, because you're always online, you're always awake, just for anyone
I've been listening. Actually really good recently about getting my 8 hours of sleep.
Oh, well done.
Yeah. But no, I'm definitely sort of a night owl sometimes. Yeah, where do I keep up? I honestly, like, Twitter is a great source of information, like as much of a cesspool as it is, as everybody says. Like, I hate it, but I also find it really valuable. Reddit as well. And more, I think I've just been like trying to be more like directed in my learning. And so, you know, when something piques my interest, say on Twitter, then I go down the rabbit hole of like looking at product documentation, if it's like a technological tool, or I'll go on YouTube and try to find longer form, say, video content. So I think I've been like, I try to spend as little time on Twitter, frankly, as possible. But I've enjoyed kind of going there, finding some interesting things, and then pursuing, you know, more learning elsewhere.
That's very fair. Do you have someone that you would interview, that you would love to interview? One of my classic questions.
Ooh, I don't know about on Twitter.
No, they don't have to be on Twitter.
But... Okay. I mean,
in AI in general.
Oh, in general. Can it be a past person, like for person from history? Because I
think can be dead.
Yeah. So the person that comes to mind immediately is Carl Jung, the psychoanalyst. Yeah, he's so interesting. I'm reading an autobiography of his where he just talks about, like, he analyzes his own dreams and talks about the origins of his theories on consciousness and identity. And it's so fascinating. And I think when you go down the rabbit hole of a lot of generative AI and kind of the discussions around, like when you go down the rabbit hole of conversations around like general intelligence, like his name always comes up and his theories always come up as sort of this like framework for understanding consciousness within like non-organic systems. I think he'd be such a great conversationalist.
Strong opinions in AI. Do you have strong opinions?
I do. Yeah. I mean, I think my strongest opinion is around interfaces other than chat input to interact with these systems. And when I say chat, both voice and text, I truly think that while that's a great way of interacting with language models, and certainly it's kind of like the, like, you know, text is the fundamental unit of interacting with language models, of course, but I think from like a user perspective, you'll see more and more interfaces that are, you know, I think more comfortable and more natural to whatever the use case and the context is. And along with that, I think what Met necessitates is more special purpose tools. So rather than going to ChatGPT for everything you want to do, I think it'll be look much more like, yeah, you know, like software prior to ChatGPT, where you had, you know, your tool that does this and your tool that does that, and you know, you had this like more diverse tech stack that you would go to. I really don't think we'll see, you know, just like a handful of software platforms dominate everything when it comes to like where users spend their time to get work done or get play done or whatever. I do think that we'll see quite a bit of diversity still, and that'll just be necessitated by, like, it's impossible to build for every single use case well. There is a lot of value in building for specific personas, and that will just then necessitate different design decisions.
Mm. I've got a question that has no relation to that. If you had an extra 3 hours a day, what would you do?
Oh, easy. I'm really into, so actually, I wish I had way more than 3 hours.
You can have five. I'll give you five.
5 hours. Okay. Well, I'd spend 3 of those hours. I've been really interested in robotics, and I want to learn robotics, and specifically like robotics engineering. I think long-term, I see myself doing work that's much more technical than what I do today. So robotics engineering, and like I've been learning, spending some time self-learning linear algebra, and so I'd spend more time to do that. And then the other one is, I love like art and arts and crafts and things. And I've been wanting to learn how to do woodworking for a long time. And so I think I would do that.
That's awesome. You can't see. Oh, maybe you can. Can you see the wand up there?
Yes.
That is a Snape's hand with a wand from Harry Potter. And my dad wood whittled that.
Whoa, that's awesome.
My dad wood whittles. I've got like most of my cupboard back there.
That's so cool.
Wood whittled. Can't say it properly.
That word is hilarious, but
yeah. So you don't live on Twitter. I was going to say you live on Twitter. Where are you able to be found? Feel free to plug something.
Well, you can find me on Twitter if you want, but I'm probably more often on LinkedIn, just at my name. Also check out omni.com, AOMNI.com. Yeah, and come say hi. We'd love to chat with folks.
Awesome. Thank you so much. That wraps up this week's episode of Unsupervised Learning. I'm your host, Renee, and I've had a great time chatting with you. As always, links to everything we discussed will be in the show notes. Make sure you reach out to our guests. Questions or feedback, reach out to pod@unsupervisedlearning.co. Until then, leave a like, follow, or rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube. And until next week, stay curious.